It's Philosophy Talk.
The left is telling you to submit or they will cancel you.
Isn't getting canceled just when somebody powerful and privileged gets criticized?
If you don't hold the right opinions, you're canceled. If you don't vote for the right candidate, you're canceled. If you own 2,000 slaves and murdered thousands of Native Americans, well, apparently we can't name an elementary school after you anymore.
Hey! Don't come around here no more. Don't come around here no more.
Is cancel culture even a thing?
Is it cancel culture or consequence culture?
What's the difference between getting canceled and just getting criticized?
Our guest is Adrian Down from Stanford University, author of Cancel Culture Transfer.
In a sense, I was canceled for 3 days, just like Jesus.
Cancel culture, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
On Wednesday, March 8th, come be part of a live recording of Philosophy Talk on the Stanford campus.
We'll be thinking about the philosophy of smell with experimental psychologist Asfa Majid.
This event is free and open to the public. Everybody's welcome. More information at philosophytalk.org.
That's Wednesday, March 8th at 7 p.m. in Leventhal Hall of the Stanford Humanities Center.
Smell you later. Has cancel culture gotten out of control?
Or are we just better at holding each other accountable?
Is canceling even a thing?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about cancel culture.
You know, Ray, I think cancel culture is a real problem these days. I mean, people are losing their jobs, they're being harassed online, their home addresses are being shared, and all because they said something that came out the wrong way.
Ah, come on, I don't know what you're talking about. When I see people who say or do terrible things, they get some pushback, and then they just go and whine about how they've been victimized on their next Netflix comedy special.
Okay, but you're talking about famous people, right? I'm talking about regular folks who are getting into trouble over innocent mistakes.
Okay, but regular folks can also say some pretty messed up things, and they deserve to be called out for it. That's not cancel culture, Josh. It's consequence culture.
But who decides the consequences? I mean, we're talking about trial by social media here, and those trials, you know, they don't go like trials in courtrooms. They're not fair. There's no presumption of innocence. The punishments aren't proportional. I mean, think about that guy who made one off-color joke about dongles at a tech conference. Someone overhears him. They take a picture. They tweet it out. His employer fires him.
Well, play stupid games, win stupid prizes.
Well, I mean, okay, it was a stupid joke, but did he deserve to be fired?
Okay, maybe not in this case, but you know, a lot of stupid jokes that people tell at work really are a problem. Those kinds of remarks can create a hostile environment for women or people of color or gays and lesbians. It's good that employers are finally starting to take that stuff seriously.
Well, I totally see why people need to be careful at work, but someone can lose their job over something they posted on social media when they're off the clock. I mean, think about that professor who tweeted some stuff about the Israel-Palestine conflict and then had his job offer suddenly disappear.
Okay, it's messed up that people can be fired for one offhand remark, sure, but the problem still isn't cancel culture. It's that employers have way too much power. You know, Josh, a lot of people can get fired anytime for any reason from jobs they need to survive.
But that just is cancel culture. I mean, employers can cancel people now, can cancel their employees. And employees aren't the only ones. Lawmakers in Florida are making it illegal for school libraries to carry books they haven't specifically approved. People are getting their speeches and events canceled if they're defending unpopular points of view. Friends and family can shun you for having the wrong political opinion.
Okay, those are all things, but there are a bunch of different things, and none of them are new. People have been boycotting stuff they don't approve of since the 19th century. And people have been shunning their family members since Cain and Abel.
Okay, that's a good comparison. But still, I feel like some things really have changed in the, whatever it is, 6,000 years since Cain and Abel. I mean, the internet's made a big difference. Like, nowadays, any offhand comment on social media that sort of comes out the wrong way, that can potentially reach a massive audience of anonymous, cranky people who get to react immediately. And by the time you notice what's happening, you've already lost your reputation.
Well, that only matters if you have a sense of shame in the first place. A lot of people don't. They seem to be thriving in your so-called age of cancel culture. I remember a day when if you got caught telling hundreds of lies, you'd have to resign. Not anymore.
Okay, but you're still talking about a tiny slice of the population. Those powerful people who think there's no such thing as bad publicity. And yeah, okay, I agree with you. For someone like that, scandal isn't a problem. It just makes them more popular with their fans. But again, I'm talking about regular folks, people like you and me.
I don't know. I still really don't think that cancel culture is a thing or that it's anything new. And I bet our guest will agree with me. It's our old friend Adrian Daub, who's got a new book called Cancel Culture Transfer.
It's so brilliant to have him back. But I'm going to guess he's going to agree with me. The digital age really has made a difference in the way that we relate to each other.
That is a big debate right now. So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to trace some of the history of cancel culture, the term and its appearances in popular culture. She files this report.
One of the earliest examples of the idea of canceling in popular culture is the 1981 song, Your Love is Canceled.
I've been interested in digital culture from like a more activist perspective.
Eve Ung traces the lineage of cancel culture in her book, Cancel Culture, A Critical Analysis.
Like many other people, you know, I watched with a lot of interest Black Lives Matter, the Me Too movement, and the impact that had on prominent figures.
Ung is a professor in the School of Media Arts and Studies at Ohio University. She says that a decade after that song came out, a screenwriter named Barry Michael Cooper was working on a script for the crime drama New Jack City when the song was playing on the radio. When the movie premiered in 1991, the idea of canceling people made its film debut.
We have like recognizable stars, right? Like Wesley Snipes is the lead character. And so he's breaking up with a girlfriend in a horrible way.
You're a murderer, Nino! I've seen you kill too many people, Nino!
Cancel it, I'll buy it now.
But Twitter really gave this idea of canceling new life. In 2009, Twitter formally adopted hashtags.
So that's when, like, people started using hashtags on Twitter saying you're canceled.
For a while, the phrase was used in a kind of playful way, but then people started using it to call people out for problematic or inappropriate behavior.
This is who's attacking me now.
One of the earlier examples took place in 2014.
The dark forces trying to silence my message of core conservative principles mixed with youth-friendly product placement have been thwarted.
Stephen Colbert had riffed on a new foundation started by the owner of Washington's NFL team, the Redskins Original Americans Foundation. Colbert was trying to point out the ridiculousness of the owner of a team called the Redskins starting a group to help Native Americans.
I was so inspired by Dan Snyder's charitable outreach that I formed my own charity, the Ching Chong Ding Dong Foundation for Sensitivity to Orientals or whatever.
The Colbert Report Twitter account sent out a tweet about his new make-believe charity, prompting an activist to tweet back, hashtag cancel Colbert, trend it. The activist behind the cancel Colbert tweet soon started getting harassed and doxxed, her address and contact details posted publicly. Fast forward to 2017.
We see figures like Harvey Weinstein being called out, you know, having to face the consequences. For him, it was actual sort of legal problems. For others, you know, like James Franco, Louis C.K., it was more what we think of as canceling, social media canceling, like I'm not following anymore.
First, they outlawed Dr. Seuss, and now they want to tell us what to say.
Jerry Seinfeld doesn't tell comedy anymore because any joke that's funny is canceled.
Ung says 2020 was the watershed year of cancel culture's conservative backlash.
2020 was the year of Black Lives Matter sort of re-emerging in the light of the George Floyd protests. And those protests, as we know, weren't just about police violence. It really expanded into a more significant critique of race and inequality in the U.S.
Some shows about police, like Cops, were literally canceled by their networks, temporarily. HBO temporarily pulled Gone with the Wind. Conservatives were angry. And people are still talking about cancel culture. In her book, Ung doesn't say whether the phenomenon is good or bad.
The take-home point for me is always not everything that looks like a cancel event is the same. We have to look at the context, like who is being canceled, who's doing the canceling, what are the reasons for the canceling, and what are the sort of power dynamics involved.
That nuanced way of thinking may not fit with the often knee-jerk mob ethos of the internet, but no one is going to cancel someone for their thoughtful, critical analysis, right? For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks so much for that great report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs, and today we're thinking about cancel culture.
We're joined now by Adrian Daub. He's professor of comparative literature and German studies at Stanford University and author, most recently, of Cancel Culture Transfer. Adrian, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
So, Adrian, you've written about James Bond songs and tech bro philosophy. How'd you get interested in cancel culture?
I'm always really fascinated with narratives about places I know well coming from people who don't know those places very well. So I was very fascinated with the kind of myths around tech that I was sort of living cheek to jowl with every day. And I got interested in all these experts for campus culture and what they've been saying for 40 years.
So, Adrian, you'll be well placed to answer this. Josh and I have been arguing about whether cancel culture is really a thing. So is it a thing?
I think I agree with both of you, and it's driving me a little crazy, to be honest.
wait, how is Josh right?
So Josh is right that I think that there are new phenomena here that we need to kind of reflect on and take account of in our politics and in our public discourse. Social media have changed the way we communicate. Our employers are pushing us to be on social media, to be more public than we were in previous generations. At the same time, notice that a lot of the examples that Josh gave would not really show up in a classic cancel culture article. That is to say, the cancel culture schema, right, that we sort of overlay over these perfectly real problems and incidents tends to distort it in ways that I think are usually unhelpful and that are politically motivated.
So that sounds a lot like what I was saying, which is that cancel culture isn't all one thing. Is that true?
It is not a thing, yes. It's definitely it's a way of making dissimilar things look similar and also making very similar things look dissimilar, right? The barista who gets fired from Starbucks is unlikely to have a big Atlantic piece written about them, but, you know, a tenured professor might.
So that's interesting. So let's try to get clear here, because it seems like a lot of things could potentially get folded into cancel culture. First of all, different kinds of people. So professors, performers, politicians, ordinary folks. And secondly, different kinds of reactions. So you could lose your job. You could get boycotted. You could get banned from social media, mobbed on social media, ostracized, disinvited, depublished, shouted down. Which of those kinds of people and which of those kinds of sort of sanction or reaction or should we be thinking about?
So I don't know about should. I actually think it's not a particularly helpful label to use. I think what we do think about is not so much the technique. I mean, you forgot statues, right? Statues are supposed to be cancel culture, getting rid of those. What they have in common is who's doing it. Cancel culture in the sort of the way it seeped into the American vernacular between 2018 and 2022 is about, it emanates from Black Lives Matter protesters, Me Too protesters. It comes from young people. It comes from college students. It does not come from Ron DeSantis. It does not come from, right-wing groups. So it's really about who's doing it and with what intention. It's usually a social justice phenomenon.
So that's really weird, because it seems like a lot of, canceling is anti-social justice. So all of these don't say gay bills, where you're not supposed to even acknowledge the existence of gay people in schools. Why doesn't that get called cancel culture?
Well, I think
too?
That's the really scary thing, right? That in the end, we end up spending time yelling about how trans students were mad at this one professor, and we don't talk about the fact that in Florida, teachers are having to remove books from their classrooms, right? And the cancel culture panic at its worst teaches us that those two things are dissimilar and we should worry about only one of those. And that can be really deleterious, I think.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about cancel culture with Adrian Daub from Stanford University.
Have you ever been ostracized for expressing an unpopular opinion? Are you worried that cancel culture is having a chilling effect? Or are you glad that offensive comedians are finally getting some pushback?
Censorship, self-censorship, and plain old politeness. Along with your comments and questions, when Philosophy Talk continues. Can someone act so insensitively that they should be told to hit the road? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about cancel culture with Adrian Daub from Stanford University, author of Cancel Culture Transfer.
Got questions about speech and its consequences? Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org or comment on our website. And while you're there, you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
So, Adrian, can you tell us more about the things that people aren't mentioning when they talk about cancel culture?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when we frame these anecdotes, that's usually what they are in this cancel culture, through this cancel culture lens, we end up leaving a whole bunch of stuff aside. We leave aside, power dynamics in the workplace, right? Very frequently, these famous cancel victims sort of are at the very top of the food chain and really, you know, either face no consequences or really only in very extreme cases, right? The famous Me Too cases, such as Harvey Weinstein. And the other thing we don't talk about is employment law, right? You were both mentioning that of course it's a problem that our employers can throw us out quite so easily. But we very rarely talk about those. It's a really interesting kind of through line in this complaint. And this complaint is decades old, right? Before we had cancel culture, we had the conversation about political correctness, et cetera, et cetera. What you often get is like this absolutely apocalyptic description of what's happening, especially on college campuses, and where this is all going to lead, and it's going to be neutral totalitarianism, and no one's going to be able to say anything anymore. And when you get to the sort of suggestions, like what should we do about this? It's just like, don't do that, right? Don't cancel, right? They never say, maybe it should be harder to fire people, right? Which would be a perfectly reasonable consequence out of all this. But they're not interested in that. They're interested in shaming our students more than they are interested in actually addressing whether people are being unfairly fired.
So I can see kind of two ways of grouping phenomena together that would suggest different ways of responding. So one thing to think is that just like speech is an important domain and it should be a protected domain, and we're just ignoring some cases of speech suppression. We should be paying attention to a lot more of them. And another thing you could think, which is different, is that what's really bad is like the unfair exercise of power. So like making your employees not be able to speak their mind is unfair in kind of the same way as making them like not be able to decide when they can go to the bathroom or when they can sit down is unfair. And that suggests that we should just group different speech problems differently.
Exactly. I do think the question of how much is this demand, no matter how inane we may think it is, backed up by actual power is the central one, right? I mean, if the governor of a state says you can't say that, well, even if they eventually lose in court, that's a scarier proposition than the people who I grade say I can't say something, right? Like over whom they have some power in this relationship, thank God, but I have a lot, right? So I do think that like thinking through the power relationships that the very simplistic framing often wants us to ignore is one way to exactly group these kinds of incidents. The thing is, if you look for the ones where the power imbalance goes along with speech prohibitions, those are almost to a T never the ones that get mentioned as the big examples of cancel culture.
What do you mean by that? Which are the ones that don't get mentioned?
The ones where someone didn't have any power and their speech was regulated. I mean, example, I've never seen an article, you know, read thousands of these articles by now for my book, never seen an article mention this weird phenomenon where Starbucks employees get fired for allegedly writing something against cops on like a cop's coffee mug. Of course, it seems tailor-made for them, but it's not, because it's actually the point of the story would be to question the corporate power of Starbucks coffee, right? But no, we want to be mad at the social justice warriors and their demands, right? And so I do think that that's an example of how there's almost an allergy for cases where it's pretty clear that what's called for is institutional reform, not that, you know, Twitter not be mad. Twitter's always mad, right?
But there are cases, right, where we're talking about regular folks who don't have power or very little power,
right,
who lose their jobs. So there's, you know, this guy, Emmanuel Cafferty, a Mexican-American guy, who was basically cracking his knuckles out the window of his truck. And someone took a photo that made it look like he was making a white power sign. And he lost his job.
Right.
And so that's surely a case where, I mean, I don't know how much power the person had who took his photo, but clearly, you know, Cafferty is just a regular guy. And I needed that job to survive.
Yeah.
And, you know, he loses his reputation, he loses his job. Aren't there a lot of cases like that?
So, I mean, right. I mean, the other case we could think of is Justine Sacco, who gets on an airplane, tweets a truly dumb tweet, turns off her phone, is fired by the time she turns it back on. But again, what is the point of that question? Is it that we are too easily agitated around social justice issues such as a white power sign? White power movements in the United States are a real problem, right? People shouldn't be making
But this guy wasn't
making
a white
one. Exactly. So then the question would be, why was his employer able to fire him so easily? And the question would be, you know, again, if we say employers have to in fact provide protection for employees who through no fault of their own end up in one of these imbroglios in social media, this is going to be a thing that we're all going to be part of at some point. We're all going to be 15 minutes of shame, right? We're going to be shamed for 15 minutes in the future. It might make sense to think through what is incumbent upon our employers in that kind of an environment.
I mean, I totally agree. It's just, it's not only I don't want to get fired for not making a white power sign. I also don't want to get trashed on social media, harassed.
Right.
I don't want to get doxxed. People are coming to my door because of something I didn't do. So it's not just employment law, right?
Right, I guess, even though how is that characteristic of cancel culture? I mean, most of the cancel culture anecdotes we think of, both sides agree on what has transpired. They disagree in their interpretation of it, right? This was a malicious misrepresentation of what this person did. You could have probably photoshopped that in an older age. That's a different question than we both agree that Louis C.K. had this habit. We appear to, for some reason, disagree on how to handle that.
Yeah, so I kind of want to hear more about social media trashing, which, like, in Louis C.K.'s case, I kind of think, like, I can't feel too bad for a guy who consistently, like, assaults and harasses women. And the cases that Josh was citing, it seems like the social media response was both really important to what happened and also out of proportion.
Right.
And so, like, that does seem like a cause for concern to me. People don't like being ostracized by their peers. It hurts them.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But let's be clear. The worry about cancel culture not only doesn't take that very seriously, it participates in the same thing. Your roving reporter piece mentioned the case of Cancel Colbert. Colbert, of course, later that year got The Late Show, which he still has, so it wasn't bad for his career. And as you mentioned in the piece, the supposed canceller had to move, got death threats, right? A cancel culture story may act like it's horrified at internet culture. It participates in internet culture. It participates in public mobbing. It participates in all the things it claims to critique. And very often, the people who end up on the receiving end of those kind of internet hubbubs have a lot less power than Louis C.K.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about cancel culture with Adrian Daub from Stanford University. And Adrian, we've got an email from Joseph. Joseph says free speech really means inquiry with standards and review. He thinks this needs to go along with people taking charge of their words rather than hiding behind anonymity. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting question. I mean, it also raises the question of whether the centrality of the campus in the cancel culture story is really that justified, right? There is a lot that we feel licensed to say and do to each other behind the mask of anonymity or even relative anonymity on social media. But of course, we see a lot of these stories are about people who do put their name to it. So I do think there is anonymity is a part of this, but it's not the only part.
I want to hear more about campuses, which you've mentioned a couple of times, and why you think they're such a central focus of these conversations.
Ooh, so that's a big part of my book. And my answer is basically this. Over 70 years, Americans have learned to really enjoy campus stories, and they've learned not to care whether they're true. right? We always have these morality plays about aging professors, young students, right? They're often very good novels. They're sometimes mediocre novels. They're sometimes good whodunits. They're sometimes bad whodunits. We have lost the ability to really ask, does that ring true to me? And that's kind of, that was the beginning of the frisson with which I started this book. That I was like, how could you possibly think this was true of a campus? What do you think is true of my university that you think that is what my employer is able to do, or, you know, that this is what my students are able to do? So I think that we've learned to live with campus fictions, and there's been also a really big right-wing cottage industry that's exploited that fact, that has been telling us exaggerated stories about campuses. And again, we've been living with those since Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American Mind in 1987.
So the people who write these things, like, didn't they go to college? How does this happen?
Well, I think that's the important thing. Everyone's gone, like, everyone who's excited about this stuff goes to college, right? But they haven't been for a while. And I think that gives you this kind of nice Manichaean, you know, picture of campus where it's, you know, the evil counselors and the upright professor who had no intention of doing anything wrong, but one day without having been canceled, right? Like it's this extremely powerful morality play that we put on, and it lives from the fact that we have a semi-familiarity. We all think we understand college a lot better than we really do.
Okay, but I mean, I totally take that point. And by the way, I love some of those campus novels too. Maybe I'm guilty of that. But there are some cases, right, that we might want to mention. Actually, a fairly recent case at a university called Hamline University.
Yeah, I remember.
Right,
that.
Where a professor, you know, her contract was not renewed.
Yeah.
And all she had done was basically in the context of a very serious, very respectful, reverential lecture about Islamic art, displayed an image from the 14th century. And there was one student, I think, who complained. And
giving a trigger warning, I believe.
And she gave warnings. Yeah. She allowed people not to be there and so on. And the Muslim Public Affairs Council issued a statement of support for her. So this seems like not a great case. And that is at a university.
Yeah. So, there are two questions here. One is, do these sorts of cases exist? And yes, very clearly. And I think, they happen with some frequency. The question is, do they happen with increasing frequency? And the thing is, if you go through the books that were bemoaning the predecessor panics to the cancel culture panic, right, or the bemoaning the predecessor to cancel culture, I should say, they're full of the same ideas. And if you look at, if anyone who's tried to sort of put this in numbers finds that, like, it appears to be, if it's increasing, it's increasing at an extremely low rate. And if anything, it might be a constant of the fact that on campuses, we're just all kind of packed together. We're all hyperverbal. We're all extremely thin-skinned about just about anything. We spend 40 years getting old together and getting kind of weird together, and then we get into these weird skirmishes.
So I'm kind of curious about how I would go about measuring whether the incidence of these kinds of things was increasing or decreasing or staying the same.
It's very tricky. So I must admit, I just went by what people who are warning about this are doing. So FIRE, which is an organization that looks at free speech issues on campus, kind of, you know, they help out academics that have gotten into this kind of hot water. So I took them to be a pretty good proxy for, you know, if they get involved, they think there's something here. And if you look at their list, you realize that, if you were to just graph it, it does go up. But a lot of that is recency bias. It's just that they weren't as involved before, right? But even then, we get something like 15, 20 cases a year, which with 6,000 universities in the United States, like, there are a lot of things that happen 20 times in 6,000 universities that we don't talk about.
So one thing that people who complain about cancel culture complain about, and I'm curious if you think it's an issue, is not sort of cases where somebody is fired, but cases where somebody doesn't say something.
Yeah, self-censorship.
Right. Do you think that's a problem? And do you think that if it's a problem, it would be harder to measure? How do we get a handle on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's always the sort of next claim, that the reason we're not seeing more of these incidents is that people are just mercilessly self-censoring. Again, all we can say is that complaint is old. It's about 40 years old. People have claimed not to be able to say the thing they then say for about 40 years. We can also say with some certainty that the studies that claim to measure this are designed to find that this is a hugely widespread problem, and they have a tendency as a lot of the cancel culture discourse does, to pathologize everyday interactions. That is to say, yes, a college dorm brings together, or a college classroom brings together students from vastly different walks of life, many of whom have lived in far more homogeneous communities before. In that environment, might one be less likely to proselytize? Might one be less likely to express one's support for a particular cause? Yes, one might, right? A lot of these studies, as far as I can tell, the ones I've read, tend to try to pathologize this fact. And they don't sort of go beyond that. And the other thing, of course, that they look for is that they look for very specific things. They look for the sort of conservative nostrums, right?
Which brings me actually to something I wanted to talk to you about, which is why aren't they talking more about other forms of speech suppression on campus? Because you think about, there's an organization called Turning Point USA, which has a professor watch list.
Yes.
Right? That sort of names and shames left-wing professors. That seems like it could risk suppressing speech or causing left-wing professors to self-censor. There's you know, some things that happen at religious university, like a professor called Larisha Hawkins, who basically got suspended for saying that Christians and Muslims worship the same God at a religious university. And of course, the laws we were talking about being passed in some states restricting what universities can and cannot teach. So these seem like cases where we'd want to say, hey, I feel like some speech is getting suppressed here. Yeah. And yet it doesn't seem to be talked about in these conversations.
Yeah, the question of free speech on campus is, to me, absolutely baffling, right? There is this kind of narrative that there was free speech on college campuses, and then the 60s happened, and the 70s happened, and identity politics happened, and black students showed up, and LGBT students showed up, and now we can't say anything anymore. Well, you mentioned religious universities. Do you know that California has a law that political speech that doesn't infringe on the First Amendment cannot be regulated by private universities, right? There is a law, Leonard Law. We can't do that. It doesn't exist, funnily enough, for religious universities. They're allowed to do it, right? That tells you a story about how where we see campus free speech. Also, right, we think a lot about, this alleged golden age of, where you could say anything on campuses. Well, until, 1963, 64, we had in loco parentis, where universities could throw you out for all kinds of stuff. I believe it was in the early 1960s that the Supreme Court decided that, no, you couldn't throw out a student for participating in a civil rights march, right? So when exactly was this golden age of campus free speech? It's really baffling, and I think it's really ahistorical. What we really got here are complex systems that clearly want to put some rules on their students, and those rules are subject to some wrangling and some disagreements. But again, this narrative that you used to be able to say this thing and now you can't is a very, very distorted picture of that.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about cancel culture with Adrian Daub from Stanford University, author of Cancel Culture Transfer.
Why is it so hard to have a public conversation these days? What's the right balance between sensitivity and straightforwardness? How can we get better at handling disagreement?
Finding common ground. Plus, commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. In the age of online shaming, one mistake is often all it takes for your life to come undone. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Adrian Daub from Stanford University, and we're thinking about cancel culture.
So, Adrian, we've mentioned a bunch of different kinds of interactions that haven't gone so great. So what do you think we can all do to help things go better in the future?
So I think one very important move is to refuse the meta level at some time. Like there's a reason to ask, what kind of a debate are we having here? But very often these days, the question becomes about the sayability and not whether or not it's worth saying, right? Like it's not like, is this kind of opinion expressible? But it's like, is it defensible? Is it a good opinion? Is it supported by research, right? We get all these calls to, to not deplatform transphobia because people don't want to actually have to debate on the merits. And I think that's an important thing to develop a BS detector for, and sort of say, you keep going there, right? Once or twice is fine, but like the third strike, let's have the actual debate, The other thing I would think about is be careful about these myths that distort power structures. If a story seems to suggest that the people that on first glance would appear to have no power in a particular interaction suddenly are all powerful, well, that's a conspiracy theory, right? That's weird, all right? That's when you're going to be told that they have gold under the polar ice caps or something like that, right? And then the other thing is be careful with anecdotes, right? We're never going to get to the bottom of all these stories. You both know how complex campus interactions especially can be. I'm guessing media is no different. It doesn't mean you can't sort of form a judgment and say, I think this is what happened on the preponderance of the evidence. But still, be careful if someone sells you a story that is too good to be true. It often isn't.
I'm thinking about something you mentioned earlier about how college campuses these days are places where students get to interact with others who are different than them and have conversations like that. And I'm wondering if you have any kind of thoughts about the special value of that and also how to manage it.
Yeah. I mean, I think what we're seeing is kind of just the friction of that endeavor and that it never feels good. And that it involves self-censorship, for lack of a better word. That there are things, there are kind of questions that we learn not to ask. That there are terms that we learn not to use. And we often learn it kind of painfully through shame, right? I think, to me, it's a little strange that we've pathologized that. That is what tolerance and mutual tolerance is all about.
Yeah, I can think of lots of times when something comes into my brain and I shouldn't say it for various reasons. So I probably shouldn't say to people, oh, the food you're cooking, it looks bad to me. Like,
yes.
Even if it happens to, it's not relevant information. And I maybe shouldn't talk if I've been the one talking in the room for like 5 minutes already.
Yeah. I mean, think of the fact that certain people on college campuses have been self-censoring forever, right? African Americans talk about code switching. What is that? That is self-censorship. It's to change the way you talk in order to accommodate yourself to a particular environment, right? I wouldn't, say that I'm gay in every part of the United States, and that's a form of self-censorship. I have a strong suspicion that that's not the kind of self-censorship that these surveys are after. They're after someone who doesn't get to say something homophobic to me.
But that actually brings me to a thought that I have about, how to move forward. I wonder if we can, this might sound a little utopian, but I wonder if we can sort of join forces, people on the left, people on the right. What if we could actually have some empathy and understand that, in fact, we're all in this social media environment in which, sometimes we're biting our tongue and sometimes we fail to and something comes out the wrong way. And maybe we could all be a little empathetic. And, of course, if something egregious happens, then it's egregious. But in the cases where someone makes a small mistake, maybe we can be a little bit more forgiving, a little bit more mutually understanding that we're kind of in a way, I mean, not quite the same boat, but in a similar boat. We're all a little bit self-censoring. We're all vulnerable to potential mobbing on the internet and so on. Could that be a way forward?
I think a certain forbearance and not leaping to condemnation is definitely something that we can do more of. It's also, of course, something, it's noticeable that a lot of our worries about cancel culture are about 19-year-olds, people who are not known for reflecting always, right? And like that'll happen, right? Are some of these people who participate in online debates going to regret some of the things they said at age 19? Of course they will. We have to, we have to be there. We also have to understand that we likely were just as strident at 19, just we didn't have Twitter in front of us.
Thank goodness. Oh my gosh.
On the other hand, I would say that we have to be careful not to confuse honest mistakes and kind of a refusal to be respectful. I'll give you an example. My grandmother, may she rest in peace, was an inveterate user of the lesser N-word throughout her life. And she'd always use it and then say, or whatever they want to be called these days. This happened for 40 years. And I said, Grandma, it's one word. You learned the word microwave. You learned the word computer. You learned the word computer mouse. How is this word creating such difficulty for you? I don't credit it. I don't believe it. I think you enjoy saying it, or you think you don't. These people do not deserve your respect, and that's a problem. So I do think that, a certain forbearance is important. But it's also important to note that often enough, whether or not we feel like we need to adjust to our fellow human beings is and is perceived by activists, not unjustly, as a form of respect or disrespect. If someone, we all change our language all the time for people we respect. If we don't, well, probably people are not wrong to read into that a certain sign of disrespect.
So I also wonder about audiences here. So Josh was expressing relief that the stuff that he said at 19 was not shared with a wide audience. Yeah. I feel really similar about myself.
Oh, God.
And this sort of makes me worried about a thing that social media does, where it makes it really easy to publish thoughts that you probably meant for your friends and send them to the entire world, where the entire world can yell about them.
Yeah, and let's be very careful. It's not social media. It's specific social media. It's noticeable that the freak out over cancel culture and the young people who allegedly perpetrated started around Tumblr and around Twitter. Those are both forms where I can't really gate what I say. Meanwhile, Uncle, you know, John and his friends are happily, like, you know, self-radicalizing on their Facebook group and storming the Capitol, but you can't see it because you have to be friends with them and you have to join the Facebook group, right? So it's not even, it really stratifies by which social media you use. Our young people are currently having to have these debates in spaces that we can all see. And as you point out, Ray, and as you pointed out, Josh, that's not a very merciful position. That's a really actually problematic. Meanwhile, some of our elders are just going just wild on Facebook, but we're never going to see, because I'm not on Facebook anymore. I just use it to, like, you know, buy baby clothes, basically, right? Like, I won't see it, and I'm not going to be part of that Facebook group, right? I'm not on Telegram. I'm not on Parler. I'm not on Truth Social. They can go just wild, and no one's going to be able to see that, yeah.
I this is actually making me think maybe it's kind of good to have a forum where everybody can read and critique your thoughts, because then you at least get corrected when you've made an error. Maybe you get corrected too harshly, but there's also something horrible about nobody telling you you're wrong when you're wrong.
I mean, that seems right, but so I agree with that. But at the same time, I also think that the concept of mercy that Adrian brought up a moment ago is also important.
Yes.
Right? I mean, you have people like Loretta Ross and Barack Obama sort of saying, you know, maybe the strategy of shaming isn't always the most effective policy. And I'd add, in some cases, if somebody actually apologizes, again, leaving aside the horrible inveterate, you know, bigots
trolls
and so
or,
on,
yeah.
trolls. But let's say someone makes a mistake and then they apologize for it. I'd like to see a world where people are a little more willing to accept a genuine apology.
Well, in a funny way, that our discussion has come full circle, because, of course, that's how the idea of cancel culture first came into broader usage. It was within fan communities who said, this was a form of self-policing. They said, look, I think that you're right to disagree with this, but this is getting a little cancel culture-y, right? Like, you're being a little too judgmental here. But it was in these very small spaces that was for fans of this very particular thing. They were principally open to anyone, but, like, unless you really cared about Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you weren't going to be part of it.
This actually is very similar to the concept of political correctness, which also arose as kind of an in-joke and then co-opted to attack anybody who thought that it was, like, wrong to say racist or sexist things in any forum.
Exactly. I mean, this is sort of the same operation, right? You take a marginal phenomenon that is very context-bound, that very specific people use under very specific circumstances, often with sort of satirical or self-ironizing intent, and you claim this is their official position, right? And this is now this totalitarian program that's taking over our public discourse.
So, Adrian, if there were one short piece of advice you want to leave our listeners with as to how to be in this age of sort of difficulty, whatever your place in the political spectrum, what would that be? What would your advice be?
I mean, I think it would be extremely sort of common sense advice. It would be to always remain cognizant of who did what to whom, why, and how, right? And once the rhetoric seems to leave that ground behind, to be very, very careful. Sometimes it's good to generalize and to sort of say, right, like when we talk about microaggressions, we can say, well, the specific instance was minimal, but it's indicative of this bigger problem. But then the person making that claim has to be able to justify why they're leaving this is what actually happened, right? And so much of the hyperbole around this just is about people wanting you to forget what really happened here.
So get the facts, get the details, really understand what happened.
And especially before you generalize about a huge group of people that you may not have interacted with very much.
That's very sensible advice. On that excellent note, Adrian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Our guest has been Adrian Dow, professor of comparative literature and German studies at Stanford University, and author most recently of Cancel Culture Transfer. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
Well, one of the things I'm thinking is that I really love the way that humanities enables us to kind of really listen to genuinely different perspectives. And I think that's a great thing that we have to offer. And the other thing I'm thinking is, I can't wait till Adrian's book comes out in English because I can't read German.
Yeah, I've been able, you know, with my rudimentary German to make my way through some of it. And it's really fantastic and such a timely and vital intervention. This very complicated and important question. We're going to put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and get access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we might feature it on the blog.
Now, a man too fast to cancel, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, while thinking about cancel culture, which gets people head up depending on whose culture is on the block, I noticed that Tucker Carlson had a congressman on his program to talk about smoking on federal property. So many straw men in their discussion, I was amazed they didn't catch fire. Tucker said, quote, "If you're smoking weed or meth, no one would say anything. What is it about tobacco, which was a religious sacrament for the American Indians? What is it about tobacco that triggers them so profoundly?" Unquote. So I learned that cheap stogies were sacred to the Navajo, and that Nancy Pelosi wouldn't mind if you smoked crack in C-SPAN. And finally, Tucker's guest lamped a stogie, and Tucker called it the smell of freedom. It smelled more like my grandfather's den, I'll bet, which was a good place to find men's adventure magazines, which went away around 1970 or so. So you don't need cancel culture if the thing dies peacefully in its sleep. Media has to be present for true cancel culture. Controversy. A teacher introduces controversial material, causing woke students to faint. Next thing you know, lawsuits, resignations, political correctness, triggering Al Franken. Louis C.K. was the poster child of what happens when you do whatever it is he did back in 2017, but he's back again doing shows. Most cancel culture is just sitting in the penalty box until the bell rings. And public shaming is difficult to do in diversity. Can't get a consensus. It's targeted. So you get kicked out of Glee Club for mumbling during the fight song, or forced to resign your commission because you forget where the submarine is, or acting out Lord of the Dance at Thanksgiving dinner. The list goes on. Blackmailers and extortionists can make a dent in postmodern shunning. And who knows? Meghan and Harry are running right now neck and neck for either Beatles-level superstardom or oblivion. But most cancel culture is contingent upon the cultural attention span. It used to be okay to make racist jokes, for example, as long as we said, "You people can't take a joke," after the punchline. And if cancel culture led to rocky roads for the well-known, conservatives felt left out, which led to a shift in cancel culture. And Trump. See, if anybody should be shunned, conservatives should do the shunning. But they can't, because shunning is such a woke thing to do. It's complicated, like the kids say. So rather than cancel culturing culture, conservatives are culture-shaming culture for not canceling itself. Of late, brown female M&Ms, for example, a limited sales promotion, I believe, are viewed by conservatives as a cancellation culturally of former M&Ms who were male working class nebbishes eager to be eaten. This is similar to the recent Ms. Potato Head flap. All the boy potatoes needed counseling, remember? There's performative Twittery anger at regulating and mandates, at confiscating gas ovens. The governor of Florida yells at Disney because it gave support to gay people, which Florida is not against, mind you, but is sick of you talking about it. So now Florida is trying to cancel Disney status by changing its tax status to woke. Meanwhile, in Fox News, Fox tried to gin up outrage over brown female M&Ms. The female newscaster told her viewers, quote, "If this is what you need for validation, an M&M that is the color that you think is associated with feminism, then I'm worried about you. I think that makes China say, oh, good, keep focusing on that. Keep focusing on giving people their own color M&Ms while we take over all the mineral deposits in the entire world," unquote. This is what keeps conservatives awake at night, worrying that China's gloating about gendered chocolate drops in America. Cancel, and China will have all the coal. Hunter Biden's laptop? Sure, cancel it, Congress, but where's the real threat? I'll tell you. It melts in your mouth, America, not in your hands, your cold, dead hands holding an M&M instead of a gun. Now, speaking of guns, Kyle Rittenhouse, come to think of it, could be an M&M. Look at his head. You could shrink that, coat it with chocolate. There's a culture package ripe for the cancel. Teen sniper M&Ms, except knowing Mars candies and how woke they are, would be transgender teen sniper M&Ms, and China would laugh. All the way to the bank, the World Bank of coal. Then they'll corner the market on cacao, and Mars will have to make their candies with carob. Once again, hippies win. Wake up, America. Get unwoke. Cancel, cancel, cancel. Boycott. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2023.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Jamie Lee, Elizabeth Zhu, Emily Huang, Merle Kessler, and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
If the liberal left wants to cancel something, why don't they start by canceling my membership to Planet Fitness? I've tried, but it's really hard.